Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, episode 53, recorded February 7th, 2011. The Audiophiliac. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by MailRoute, a secure hosted service that filters viruses and spam for companies of any size. Visit MailRoute.info and sign up with the email filtering service that Leo and Tom use. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here with UltimateAVMag.com and HomeTheater.com. My guest geek this week is Steve Guttenberg, audio journalist and author of the Audiophiliac blog on CNET.com. Hey, Steve, welcome to the show.
Hey, Scott, how you doing?
I'm doing great, thanks. Thanks a lot for being here. Thank you. Those who are tuned in to the live video stream at live.twit.tv or logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv can post questions for Steve, and I'll pass on as many as I can. So, Steve, you've been an audiophile for a long time, right?
I would say since birth, possibly.
Okay. Did you come by it honestly? Were your parents audiophiles? Did they have stereo equipment around the house?
They did. My mother was an avid music fan and listened to records all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And because I'm a child of the 50s, we had a jukebox.
Really?
Because people in the 50s bought jukeboxes for some reason. And we had this jukebox in like the den. And it was the kind with the bubbles and the pipes and everything going on.
Oh, man, the Wurlitzer. That's great.
And maybe that was it. Maybe watching that mechanism of, you know, taking the record out and, you know, that big arm and the massive tone arm plopping down on the thing. Maybe that affected me. I never made that connection before. Scott, you're bringing things out in me. I forgot.
There you go.
Repressed audiophile memories. Because you kind of look like a doctor, you know? You look like a
Now,
shrink.
Tell me everything.
I'm just opening up.
Well, that's great. That's good. That's exactly what we want on this show.
Okay, good.
Now, those days, of course, as you mentioned, everybody listened to music.
Yes, what a concept.
They sat down and they listened to records. And nowadays, of course, we don't. Primarily, yeah. except maybe for audiophiles. Why do you suppose that is?
You know, I have this theory. My theory is that with the introduction of the CD, because it was so easy to do, you'd stick in the disc, you'd hit play, and then you'd have to worry about it for the next 50 minutes. So people started to do other things. They started, you know, washing the floor and knitting and doing all sorts of stuff except actually listening.
Because when you had a record, you had to turn it over every 20 minutes or so.
Right. You had to be more attentive. Mm-hmm. So I think it sort of automatically led to that. Of course, the audiophile in me would conclude that the other thing was the digital audio was just less interesting. It just didn't pull people in as much. So
I hear that an awful lot.
To listen.
Yeah, I hear that a lot, that digital audio, and in particular compressed digital audio, MP3 and so on, is much less emotionally involving.
Mm-hmm.
Would you agree with that?
I do agree, yeah. And I think that the interesting thing is that that over time, now that we've had a generation grow up with digital audio, that they've been so conditioned not to listen that even when they go to live music concerts, it's hard for them to listen, especially now they can be texting or emailing or doing all
tweeting,
sorts of things.
Yeah.
Eating. Well, you know, people are always eating, but I'm just saying. Hey.
No, I said tweeting.
Oh, tweeting. I'm sorry. Tweeting. All sorts of ings were going down. And,
right,
and you know, I spent $300 to see the Rolling Stones in maybe 5 years ago at Madison Square Garden.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't think there's so many people were tweeting or emailing, but they did talk through pretty much the entire concert. People all around me.
Really?
Yeah.
I have to say, I saw the Stones in, must have been 89 or so, on the Steel Wheels tour.
Uh-huh.
And it was so loud. I can't imagine anybody talking, or even if they were, I would never have heard it. I decided to try and find out how long it would take before I had to put my earplugs in, and it was like after half a song.
Oh, yeah.
And they played for hours.
Yes.
I actually got to interview Mick Jagger, which was cool.
You did? Really?
Yeah, it was really cool. And I got to walk around backstage, and underneath this stage, which was like 100 feet by 50 feet or something, was just floor to ceiling, 10 feet high anyway, of Crown amplifiers. Huh. So no wonder it was so loud.
So Scott, you're Mr. 3D, right?
I am. You like 3D? I do. I recognize its limitations, but I also enjoy it when it's done well.
Well, I'm asking that for that's a leading question.
Okay, good.
Because I'm pretty sure it was the Steel Wheels tour that, as that tour was starting, Mick Jagger hired this friend of mine, Jerry Marks, who's a 3D genius, to film portions of that tour in 3D.
Really? So
did you ever see any of that footage?
I never did, no.
Yeah, and
you'll have to give me his contact info, because I'd like to talk to him about that. Maybe get him on the podcast to talk about that experience and what he's done since then.
I'll hook you up, because he's a really interesting guy, and I was responsible in some tiny way for him getting this gig of being the guy to document the Stones tour in 3D.
Oh yeah, how's that?
Because I ran into him in Manhattan. I lived on 71st Street at that point, and he said to me, oh, I'm going to have this meeting with Mick Jagger tomorrow. And I made a video to show him, but it's a silent video, and I want to put music to it. And I don't know what music to use. So I said, well, come up to my apartment. I'll play you a bunch of things. And I played a bunch of stuff, and he wound up settling on the Neville Brothers' Yellow Moon.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
And that's what he used, and he had the meeting with Jagger, and everything went well, and he got hired. He actually got hired to do a tiny bit of the tour, and he wound up being on most of the tour shooting it.
Wow. So, I wonder if he was in L.A. He might have been when I was there.
It was the whole country, actually.
Yeah. That he was shooting. Wow. Well, that's very exciting.
Connect you with him.
Excellent. Excellent. So getting back to the topic we were at before, which was how people aren't really listening to music these days like they used to, except for audiophiles. Now, audiophiles, of course, are an exception. But my impression is that the audiophile subset of the population, shall we say, is a relatively aging demographic. Right. Are there many young people coming into our hobby?
Hey, Scott, funny you ask. <'Cause> I did a poll over the weekend on CNET.
On this weekend?
This weekend, yeah.
Oh, great.
And the response was huge. When I last checked, there were like 184 comments.
Oh, man.
And maybe 1,500 people voted in the poll. Uh-huh. And the thing that was so interesting was, when I posed the question, I said, are there any 20 or 30-something audiophiles? I would say half of the people that responded were teenagers.
Teenagers,
and,
really?
Yeah. And they said, oh, yeah, I've always been an audiophile, or my father's an audiophile, or I'm weird and I'm an audiophile because no one else understands why I would care about any of this stuff. Mm. And they have systems, speakers and stuff that were handed down from their relatives, or they saved up their money and bought it. One 14-year-old guy, he emails me and he says that he has UE18s, which are $1,000 in-ear headphones. Ultimate ears, yeah. And he has I forget his amplifier, but he had a really serious system for 14. And he was thinking about upgrading. And that's how he's definitely an audiophile, because he's thinking about what's going to be next.
Right, right.
So, I was so thrilled by this response. And I was so thrilled that, because my CNET readers can be a pretty hostile group sometimes. And most of them were really positive. And actually, the negativity that in their comments didn't come from anybody young that I recall. It was all older people saying, well, of course the kids aren't into music or into sound, because all the music sucks, because it's all crappy sounding recordings. So,
a somewhat different issue, of course.
So it is a different issue. Right, right, right. But, that's partially the thing that the older generation always says about the younger generation's music, is that it sounds like junk, right?
Yeah, so,
I mean,
true enough.
My parents were listening to Frank Sinatra records and saying, there's Beatles. What is this crap? It's noise. It's distorted sounding. How could you possibly like that? So
some things
never change, you know.
True enough. True enough. Maybe one factor also is that I've heard at least that young people are coming back to LPs, to vinyl LPs.
Yeah.
That it's actually quite popular amongst the younger crowd, and I'm curious why that might be.
Because it's cool.
because it's retro, maybe, I suppose.
And retro, yeah, right. But you know what's interesting? This vinyl coming back has been been coming back for ages. But the thing that's different now is that when I go to record stores in New York City, still has actually quite a few record stores, is it's not that I'm seeing Dark Side of the Moon and Kind of Blue in these for vinyl. I'm seeing current bands. I mean, there's a store in Lower Manhattan, J&R Music World,
I've heard of it, certainly.
It's a big store. I mean, it has to be 100 feet deep. And right now, the entire right side of the store is all vinyl.
Wow.
So it's not just 10 titles or a little shelf on the side with a couple of records. It's thousands of titles.
It's amazing, because I remember in my college days going to Tower Records in L.A. Mm-hmm. and in San Francisco when I was going to school. And, you know, I watched as all the vinyl got replaced by CDs.
Yeah.
And the vinyl shrank and disappeared. And now, of course, Tower Records is gone, too, at least as a brick-and-mortar store.
Right.
Here in L.A., we have Amoeba Music. I haven't been down there in a while. Have you been there?
Yeah, I've been there, and it's still cooking.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it's a great store.
There's this annual event that's called Record Store Day. Have you heard of that?
No, I haven't.
Yeah. And they do a big deal with it at Amoeba. And this guy from the Smashing Pumpkins, do you know that guy with the shaved head?
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about? So there was a clip of him on YouTube a couple of years ago in a record store in Chicago, where I think he's from. And a woman comes up to him and says, with a camera, and says, hey, do you know that today's Record Store Day? And he said, no, what is that? And she tells him about it. So next year, he was at Amoeba for Record Store Day doing an in-store performance.
Wow. Wow. So, when is Record Store Day?
You know, I don't know. I'm sure on the internet we could figure that out.
Google that out. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think it's in like April or May or something.
Yeah. Got a couple questions in the chat room for you. Knox Harrington wants to know, do you think that music services, if they have enough bandwidth to sell high bitrate audio files, F-I-L-E-S, will that help? Turn people more into listening to music again?
It's like chicken soup. It couldn't hurt. You know, it's... well, you know, there's a couple of places to buy... high definition downloads. There's a site called HD Tracks, which is from the guys that started Chesky Records. They have this other company, HD Tracks. And Lynn Records in Scotland has a site, I think, called Lynn Records, that they sell downloads at all different levels of resolution.
And there's
I spoke to Mike Jabara, I think that's how you say his name, who is the CEO of Warner Music last year. Mm-hmm. And he told me that they're actually getting very close to doing in mass high resolution downloads.
Warner Music is?
Warner Music. And that, well, whatever it is turning into. When I talked to him a couple of weeks ago, it was Warner Music. Maybe it isn't Warner Music anymore. But anyway, that he said all Warner releases of the last 5 years have been archived in 24-bit 192. So there's a lot of material. Not to mention, of course, older recordings where analog recordings could always be, you know, converted to digital at any resolution you want. So
right.
So it's the future of high resolution downloads looks really good. Although I'll tell you an interesting thing is that Mike said they were not placing their bets solely on downloads, that they would be doing more Blu-ray stuff and more vinyl.
So, that's very good. I'm certainly glad to hear about Blu-ray music. I know that, for example, there's another download service called 2L out of Norway. And I'm pretty sure they also publish Blu-ray music, you know, Blu-ray music discs as well. Not music videos, but where the primary content is music. And there's probably some video content on there, but that's primarily what it's for, is for the music, for high-resolution music. And what was the other one? Oh, B&W also has a high-res
download service. Right, the Peter Gabriel service. Site.
Yeah,
right,
exactly.
It's the Peter Gabriel site.
Exactly.
So I have a question for you.
Oh, well, that's unusual. Go ahead.
I want to pick your brain for a sec.
Yeah, sure.
So in music and in video, we've had all this time where people were buying physical product.
Right.
And they would buy it, you know, on an LP. And then when CDs came out, they were buying CDs. And then they were buying briefly SACD, DVD, blah, blah, blah.
Very
and
briefly.
In video,
yes.
We went from tape to DVD to Blu-ray. Mm-hmm. And obviously, the future is in downloads.
Yes.
So here's my question to you. Once there isn't a physical format, will buyers buy the next format, the next higher quality format as a file? They already have it, let's say, as a file. They have The Godfather sitting on their hard drive, right?
Right.
In some sort of file form. And then Paramount or Francis Ford comes out and says, we have this new format and it's even better. But since you can't touch it, would anybody feel like, oh, I got to get a new one? That icon on my display, it looks kind of tired now. I want a new shiny icon for the new format. I don't think so.
This is a really great question.
Icon.
Yeah. It's a really great question. And one that I asked in a recent poll on ultimateavmag.com. You and I are fond of both of us doing polls, which really takes the temperature of the pulse, if you will, of our readership. And I asked that question, a similar question, which was, is the end of physical media inevitable? In other words, is Blu-ray really the last physical medium that we're going to see, or because of downloading particularly, or will we see something, or will physical media continue to be developed? I gave an example, I've written in the past about technologies like holographic crystals, right, with terabytes of storage. And or will physical media become a niche market, like I said, like vinyl LPs? And that may, in fact, not be entirely true, but
right.
Let's say that it is for now, just for sake of argument. And the majority of my readers seem to indicate that they thought physical media would still continue to be developed. But an almost equal number said that it would become a niche market. Not that many said that it would disappear altogether.
Because they're used to it, I guess, too.
Yeah, well, there are several issues. One is, I think human nature includes a desire, if you're going to own something, to have something physical that you can hold in your hands. There's also the issue of permanence, what I call permanence. You know, if it's sitting on your hard drive, that's all well and good. But what happens when your hard drive crashes?
Well, you have a backup.
Maybe you do, maybe you don't, depending on the DRM, you know, digital rights management. That may be a problem.
Okay.
And then there's portability. And certainly with digital copy, in terms of when you buy a Blu-ray, sometimes it comes with a DVD version of it and sometimes with what's called a digital copy, which means you can then copy it onto your iPod or iPad or whatever.
Okay.
And take it with you that way. But discs are so easy to take over to grandma's house and pop in the player, you know, and play on her TV, that is another argument in favor of physical media, in my opinion. Then there's the issue of downloads and streaming requiring a certain amount of bandwidth. And the more resolution those files have, the higher the resolution, the greater the quality, you know, the more bandwidth it requires. And the U.S. is lagging pretty far behind some of the rest of the world anyway, in terms of generally available bandwidth. So that's another reason that I think streaming, while it's popular and certainly effective for music, is not going to be as effective for video, because videos take so much more data.
Well, I would be happy if that was true. I mean, I think it's an interesting thing that at least some record companies and Netflix, for example, can't get there fast enough not to have physical media anymore.
It's right? True. So yeah, it's absolutely true.
But I think that once they've achieved that, see, I don't know. Let's take Netflix, for example, right? When they have their thing where you could have one at a time or two at a time or five at a time or eight at a time, right? Well, you're paying more and more money to have that. But once you have unlimited streaming, well, then you don't need the eight at a time anymore. You can just pay the $7.99 a month and be done with it and watch movies 24 hours a day.
Right.
So they wind up making less money. Why do business is, you know, rush to create systems where they make less money?
Right. Exactly.
I don't understand that concept.
Well, here's another question from the chat room that actually links into one of the questions I was going to ask you. Beatmaster asks, what kind of music do you recommend or do you like to listen to? And the question that I was going to ask that's related to that is, what does good sound sound like?
Yeah, that is the question, you know.
It is. Well, so what does good sound sound like? And what do you recommend? What titles? Do you have any examples of titles that would, in fact, sound good and might make good demo pieces or at least examples of what you can do with the recorded medium?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I do have a long association with Chesky Records.
And they make great records.
Right. They make great records. And one of the things that makes them great is what they don't do when they make records. They don't compress them. They don't equalize them. They don't multi-track them. The entire band is recorded live in one room. The vocalist isn't in a separate room listening to headphones to somebody else.
Right.
So the fact that it's not just a sound question, it's like how records are made question. You know, there's this amazing documentary that was done, not a documentary, a TV show in the 50s, 1957, called The Sound of Jazz. And it was a live TV special on CBS, and it was sort of an introduction to jazz for America.
Mm-hmm.
And it had Thelonious Monk, it had Count Basie, it had Billie Holiday, Jimmy Giuffre. It's an hour-long special.
Wow, is that available on DVD anywhere, do you know?
I'm pretty sure it is, actually. It's called The Sound of Jazz.
I'd love to get that.
And I wrote a story about it about 10, 12 years ago that at the end of the special, there's a card that comes up and it says, if you enjoyed The Sound of Jazz, you can buy The Sound of Jazz on LP.
Mm.
So this was in the 80s. So I said, well, I'm not going to find the LP so fast, but I'm sure it's on CD. So I go to Tower Records, buy the CD, go home, listen to it. And I immediately knew that it was not the same thing.
Hmm.
It was the same musicians and the same tunes, but it wasn't the same performances. So I'm reading the booklet that came with the CD, and it explained that the what you're hearing on the CD and on the LP is actually rehearsals for the TV special that were done in a recording studio.
Huh.
So I called up that one of the producers of the record was... Nat Hentoff, the jazz critic, who's also a record producer.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me, he said, well, we wanted to put out the TV special, the sound of the TV special on the record, but Columbia Records thought that the rehearsal sounded better, so that's what they wanted to put out. But this, and maybe they do sound better, but the interesting thing is that once these same extremely talented musicians were in a studio, Billie Holiday wasn't with the band. She was in a booth listening to the band play over headphones.
Right.
And the bass player was in a booth and the drummer was in a booth.
Right.
Even in 1957. So even though they were just as good of musicians on the TV show, they were more like they were playing in a club. They were all in the same room. They could all hear each other acoustically. No one
wore headphones. They were on a stage, essentially. They were performing for a live audience, right?
No, it wasn't
or a maybe not. There maybe wasn't an audience there, but they were on a stage.
They were on a sound stage, yeah.
Yeah.
And so they could see each other and hear each other and react to each other in real time and acoustically.
Yeah.
And that, see, is one of the interesting things about older records versus current records is that once you basically put up walls between the musicians, they can't hear themselves anymore. They can't hear each other anymore. They're basically hearing a mix that the engineer supplies to them over headphones.
Right.
And that changes the way they play. So that's one of the big differences beyond the equalization and compression, all that stuff that happens in modern records. The fact that people can't play the way they would in a concert affects the way they play, affects yeah. their performance.
Now, another guy who does that, aside from Chesky, is Mark Waldrop at AIX Records. Do you know his recordings?
Yeah, yeah. He makes those discs sound great and look great. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Because he includes video along with the music. He shoots mm-hmm. video during the performance, but that's what he captures is a performance right. of an entire right. band on a stage. Right. In fact, in an auditorium, right. Not with an audience, but mm-hmm. with the band on stage, all together, all playing together, as if it were a performance. He calls mm-hmm. these things, in fact, private performances, because uh-huh. you, right, you right. watch the video and you see them playing and you hear them mm-hmm. you hear them as they're playing, and you hear what they're playing as you're watching them. It's the same thing. Mm-hmm. It's not different, as you said. Mm-hmm. Which brings up another question. What do you think about...
So, wait, we just want to finish that, though.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Go right ahead.
So what I would listen to... Mm-hmm. So if I was, you know, listening to a review of a piece of equipment, or if I just, from my own curiosity, wondered what it sounded like, I mm-hmm. would want to use a Chesky recording, an AIX recording. There's another label called MA Records.
Oh, yeah. Isn't that musical art? It stands for something. I can't remember now.
It's actually the English version of a Japanese word that means space.
Oh,
means
okay.
space in Japanese. It's a Japanese company, even though it's owned by an American.
Right.
And anyway,
the guy
so
I went to school
use...
with, by the way, as it happens.
Really?
Years and years ago at Cal State Northridge, Todd, right?
Todd Garfinkel.
Yeah, exactly. We went to school together in college, and I ran into him years later at uh-huh. a Stereophile show, and he had his little table there with his records, and he said, "Hey, Scott Wilkinson." I went, "Whoa!"
He's a really great guy, and he makes awesome sounding records.
Yeah, yeah, so, absolutely.
In other words, if you use one of those records to listen to a speaker, it's not like you're only going to listen to that kind of music, but you get a truer evaluation of what a speaker sounds like by using music that's not equalized and compressed and stuff. So
right.
you can listen to your Led Zeppelin, you can listen to Black Eyed Peas, you can listen to anything you want, but you can't listen to Black Eyed Peas to know how good a piece of equipment sounds
mm-hmm.
because it's been so messed with that you can't say, "Oh, that tweeter sounds a little harsh." Well, I wouldn't know if it sounded harsh if you're listening to the Black Eyed Peas. Not that I want to pick on them or anything, but so I would listen to evaluate things the most natural possible sounding records, so I get a fair, you know, grasp as to what a piece of equipment sounds like.
Right. Well, this stimulates several questions that I want to ask you. But if you'll hold on for just a second, I'd like to take a moment to thank our sponsor for this episode, MailRoute. Businesses of every size use MailRoute. One user, 50,000 users, doesn't matter. MailRoute will protect you from spam and viruses, simplify your life, and make your email usable again. Typical MailRoute customers see a 95% reduction in their inbound email volume with virtually no false positives. Leo Laporte loves MailRoute. He uses it with his domains and has been for more than 6 years. Tom Merritt also started using MailRoute, and he can now use email domains he gave up on as hopeless. There's no hardware or software to install. You just sign up with MailRoute, then change the MX records for your domain to start your mail flowing through them, and then they do all the work for you. Visit MailRoute.info to sign up. As a TWIT listener, you'll receive a 10% discount off the life of your account. Small business accounts start at $2 per user per month for 10 users. And because of demand from the TWIT Army, MailRoute has added a new service for individual users at less than $30 a year. Visit MailRoute.info and sign up with the email filtering service that Tom and Leo use. So, Steve Guttenberg is here. Not the actor, by the way.
Right. Don't get excited. I had the name first, by the way. So.
Oh, you're.
I felt like he's copying me. I'm older than he is. Yeah.
You're older than he is. Okay. So, yeah. So he's copying you.
Yeah.
But you are a fine audiophile and a fine audio reviewer.
Thank you.
And I've read many of your things over the years, and the questions that got stimulated in my brain from that last little conversation was. One of them was, what about multi-channel music? Do you listen to much of that? Do you think that might be something that could get people involved in actually listening to music again? Or are you more or less a two-channel guy?
I am definitely a two-channel guy. But, you know, in 10 years ago when we had a few years of SACD and DVD audio,
mm-hmm.
I was incredibly frustrated that there wasn't... enough discussion in the engineering community as to what to do in multi-channel mixes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like so many of the mixes I heard, because, you know, I was getting promo, so I was hearing a lot of stuff. And I always had the feeling that the mix was sort of random. Well, we'll put the guitar in the right rear channel and the tambourine over there. It didn't have any coherence to it. It didn't, you know, there was those two schools. One was that you have the band in the front and then the ambience around you, which
in the surrounds, yeah.
Yeah, in the surrounds. That sort of made some sense. Although you could achieve the same effect by playing any stereo recording in Dolby Pro Logic and get pretty much the same thing. You didn't need to buy an SMCD or DVD audio to hear that. Or then there were the ones where they would put you in the middle of the band, which always struck me as a really bizarre idea. But there were many records that were made that way. But there were,
I have to say, though, as a musician, I like being in the middle of the band. I like those, what Mark Waldrop calls stage perspective. But that's just me. I'm pretty weird in that regard.
You know, it's okay. Different strokes. But there were occasional, you know, glimmers of hope. And one of them was the Talking Heads. They put out this box. I think it was called The Brick. And it was all of their studio records. And it was mixed by Jerry Harrison, the keyboard player from Talking Heads.
Mm-hmm.
And when this thing came out, it was pretty late. It was actually a dual disc. It was maybe 5 years ago. It basically expanded the stereo mix and just made it bigger, like a big C shape, basically.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it made things that within the mix just come out more. You just heard subtle things that were sort of buried in the stereo mix were so much clearer. And it was just fantastic. And I thought when I first got it, I said, wow, someone's finally figured it out. But I thought maybe you have to really be a total audiophile, total nerd to notice. But then I noticed on Amazon in the reader, you know, reviews of it, that a lot of people noticed it. And I was hoping that that would sort of spark something in the engineering community to sort of rethink how they were doing surround mixes.
Mm-hmm.
But that basically didn't happen. And the other one that was kind of interesting was the Doors DVD audio discs, because Bruce Botnick, who was the original Doors recording engineer, when they approached him to do these DVD audio versions, he said something like, you know, I've done so many remasters of the Doors catalog, I'm really bored. You know, it's like, you got to give me something new, man, because this is, I just can't do it again. This is like the eighth time I've remastered the Doors catalog. So he basically got Warner's and the Doors people to let him remix the records. He said, they're, you know, they sound like 60s records. I can make them sound better now. I know how to make records sound better than I did in 1967. Yeah, so they actually sound better than the things, and not just because they're 9624. It's the way their mix is different,
right?
And he also did a really brave thing where he put Jim Morrison hard in the center channel, so you can actually hear Morrison better than you can in a stereo mix. So there were some little glimmers here and there.
I noticed the same thing in the early days. The early Eagles surround mixes sounded pretty gimmicky, you know, with the cowbell clanking at you from the one of the surround channels or whatever. But as engineers got more experience, you know, they got more sophisticated, and the sound field did become more coherent. I really do enjoy listening to Mark Waldrop's multi-channel recordings, again, from the stage perspective, but as a musician. And I know there are a few musicians in the chat room that are saying the same thing. SoCal Ray Jr. asks, why is it that audiophiles seem to be more concerned with the equipment and the speakers more than the acoustics of the room that they're sitting in? Do you agree? Do you think that's true?
That's a great question, and I'll give you the I have to admit the answer. The answer is that it's too hard.
<That's why>. Too hard because, to deal with the acoustics, huh?
You know what's an amazing thing is that dealing with acoustics from, let's say, an audiophile perspective, but from any perspective, it is really hard. And when they, redid Carnegie Hall like 20 years ago, and they had the best acousticians in the world, everyone said it sounds worse after they did the remodeling. And how many times did they do, Lincoln Center's halls? They've done it many, many times with the best engineering talent money can buy. And it's a really hard thing to pull off. So to expect an average audiophile to figure out how to make their room really sound better. Now, I mean, there's basic things like having a rug, you know, a thick rug to stop reflections off the floor and, you know, damping things and stuff like that. But beyond really basic stuff like that, I don't think it's within the capabilities of an audiophile or a dealer for that matter to really make significant improvements to the acoustics of a room.
Yeah, I agree. That is a very difficult thing to do. We're actually working on that. I'm working on that in the testing studio here in Los Angeles with mm-hmm. Tony Germani of PMI, who is a very good acoustical guy. I guess we could call him an acoustician. I think that's valid.
Okay.
And we've got a bunch of acoustic treatments that we're going to put into a little bit of a problematic room to see how much better we can make it. But you're right. It is a very difficult thing to do. And it's not so surprising that a lot of audiophiles aren't really doing it.
Yeah, so don't be too hard on those audiophiles. Although, you know, I want to say something about, because I thought this question was going in a different direction.
Uh-huh.
You know, I think that most audiophiles, and that would include myself, can listen to music and enjoy music on just about anything, on a table radio. I have a Tivoli table radio, and I can mm-hmm. listen to music on it and enjoy music on it. And I can listen to music on a lot of things and enjoy it. The only thing an audiophile system can do is to make it sound better.
Mm.
And being an audiophile, to me, means that I'm hypersensitive to what sound sounds like. So I really, I fixate on that. Now, that's not to say that I don't like music. I love music. It's a huge part of my life. But I really love the sound of music.
Mm.
And just the other day, I was at a store in Manhattan, In Living Stereo, and I was listening to a speaker there, and I was listening to Led Zeppelin, the first record, You Shook Me. And mm-hmm. I noticed something in the mix that I had never heard before. I've played this record hundreds, maybe 1,000 times in my life. And mm-hmm. there were things in that recording that I never heard before. And that was really exciting to me. And that's why I'm an audiophile, because that I get off on that kind of thing.
Right, so, right. About experiencing something over and over again, and yet hearing something, experiencing something new, perhaps mm-hmm. each time, or at least sometimes, right. When you upgrade your speakers or whatever.
Right.
So the other question that I wanted to get to is, you're also an audio reviewer, and mm-hmm. and you know what good sound should sound like as a reviewer. How important are professional reviewers in the land of audiophilia?
Mm-hmm. Well,
I mean, that's somewhat of a self-serving question, of course. You're going to say, yes, well, they're very important because I'm a reviewer.
I'm vital. I'm a vital part of this community.
Sorry about that. But I mean, you know, in general terms, an educated ear really is a value to those who don't have an educated ear, I would say.
Right. But here's the hard part. I get emails constantly. It's so tough being me. You know, being more famous than Steve Guttenberg, the actor, has its downsides. And the thing is that people ask me to recommend speakers to them or amplifiers or all sorts of things to them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a difficult thing to do because I don't know what it is that they would like. If someone asked me to recommend something I like, well, I could do that. But I don't
sure.
know how useful that would be. I, you know, before I, you know, was a world famous audio critic, I sold hi-fi for 16
that's right.
years at Sound by Singer in New York. So I
oh,
had
yeah.
the experience
great store.
Of. Well, it was. It's
it was
next store.
Now. It's yeah. gone now. Yeah, but at the yeah. time,
right. And so I sat in a room or many rooms for 16 years with thousands of people playing them hi-fis and to sort of get into their head as to what it is that they were looking for. Many customers would say to me, well, what do you like? And I would say, well, I'll tell you what I like, but that's not necessarily what you would like. It's like asking mm-hmm. me to pick the color of your room or something. It's not, I may be the professional and I may have the experience, but I can't, my job is to help you figure out what's going to work best for you. I could do that as a salesman because I was in a room with all sorts of great stuff and I could play, hit, let's play A, let's play B, let's play C. What do you think? And
what do you
I could
think?
Talk
yeah.
it over with them, right?
As so a reviewer, of course, you can't do that. You're not sitting there with the people at all.
Right. So all I can do is, the to the best of my ability, describe what something sounds like and hope that that has some sort of meaning to some people. You know, like, just because a speaker can play Led Zeppelin really well doesn't mean it can play Beethoven really well. So I'm trying to point that out in a review and hope that the reader picks up on those cues to saying, oh, this is the one for me kind of thing. You know, so
boy, that's a tough one, too. Trying to describe in words what something sounds like.
Yeah, it's like dancing about architecture or something. One of those things. You know?
Yeah, right. Almost reminds me of synesthesia, you know.
Right.
Hearing the sound of words or whatever. Got a couple more questions in the chat room. Virgil asks, where does a Bose system land in your ears? or in your estimation?
Wow, I like the idea of it landing in my ear. Well, I have to admit something to this, to our viewers here.
Yes.
That I did buy a Bose system early on.
Really?
This is before I was a world famous audio critic.
And
before
okay.
I sold hi-fis. I bought a Bose 501 system, which was basically the second one. You know, the original was the 901.
The 901, which I had in college. Everybody had in college.
Right. And I think there was a 301, but actually I think the 301 came after the 501. So I think the 501 was the second Bose system. It was like a short floor standing speaker. And it was a really funny thing that when I bought this, the salesman was trying to talk me out of it, saying, you know, Bose, can't you hear? But I was so, you know, convinced by their advertising, basically, that Bose was the real deal and a great thing. I bought this Bose system. And I didn't hate it or anything, but eventually I was aware of its shortcomings and I moved on, actually.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I think that Bose has the unique privilege of being the only audio-only speaker company in the United States, at least, that most people know.
Right.
There isn't another company, especially if you're young, let's say, if you're under 35 or something, that the name JBL wouldn't be the first thing you think of when you said, what's an audio company?
Right.
And people can, you know, Sony and Panasonic are saying, but I'm saying about companies that make only audio-related products. Bose is the only company that advertises in mass media on TV, on radio, and newspapers, mm-hmm. on the internet. That's the only name they ever see. So Bose is a brilliantly marketed company that makes brilliantly mediocre products.
It echoes exactly what I have said about Bose all along, yes.
And they're hardly ever reviewed.
I don't think they even send their stuff out for, they don't allow their stuff to be reviewed.
Not by anyone with credibility.
One of our chat room members, Web1238, asks, what would you prefer for music listening, horn-loaded or cone speakers, cone-type drivers? Do you have a preference of dynamic or horn or electrostatic or magnaplaner for that matter?
I like them all. Well, I think the horn speakers, first of all, I mean, they have their place in that they're extremely dynamic. They're extremely efficient, meaning they can play loud with very few watts. Movie theaters, you know, almost always have horn speakers. And I think that right. horns have a natural affinity for home theater.
Mm-hmm.
And I think horns are great, especially for rock music and any really dynamic music. I think my preference would be horns for someone who likes that. For people, you know, it's always tougher because in my salesman's days, people say, oh, I like everything. I want to listen to everything and make everything should sound good. That's a tougher thing to pull off. You know, mm-hmm. to find the speaker that makes everything sound great. That's tough.
Right.
So,
right.
By the way, Scott, I don't know how much time we have left.
We've got a few minutes left.
Oh, I brought a prop.
Oh, let's see the prop.
And I want to show you this prop.
Okay.
Hopefully I can frame this well enough so that you can see it. Let's see.
Unfortunately, our video isn't working all that well, but okay. we can take a look. Oh, it's an old, looks like a tube amp.
Well, actually, it's not old. It's brand new. And it's a tube headphone. It's a tube headphone amplifier from a company called Bottlehead. It's bottlehead.com.
Okay.
And this is a kit. And it's $219 as a kit.
Mm-hmm.
It's called the Crack, as in like a crackhead. And it sounds incredible. It does not sound good for $219. It sounds really, really good.
Regardless of price, you're saying.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would sound good if it cost $1,000.
Wow. So, this is great because you've segued beautifully into F-Loop's question, which is that you seem to follow headphones more so than other audiophile writers. Why is that?
They're light.
Easy to review.
Yes, I live in New York City. I don't have a lot of room for big stuff.
Right, I
like headphones, and I think that, you know, this when we're talking about the younger generation becoming audiophiles, I think that headphones and headphone amplifiers are sort of the gateway drug for them. Because you can buy great stuff like this bottlehead amplifier for $219 mm-hmm. and get definitely hear high-end audiophile quality sound, which would be much tougher to achieve with speakers and amplifiers.
So and much more expensive, too.
I'm sorry?
Much more expensive with speakers and amplifiers, too, generally speaking.
That's what I'm saying. So a high school kid or a college kid could get into headphones and get great sound and not break the bank.
Yeah. What do you recommend in terms of headphones? You know, high quality, good value. You've listened to a bunch. What do you like?
Well, I think the best and certainly the most affordable headphones, I mean, the best, most affordable headphones come from Grado, which is in Brooklyn, New York, which is where mm-hmm. I live. Mm-hmm. And they make a model called the SR60i, which is $79. Mm-hmm. And it sounds really, really good for that kind of money.
Mm. And you pair it with this $200 amp, it would be amazing, huh?
Yeah, it would. And I like Monster's in-ear headphones, the Turbines. I think those are really great.
Oh, that's good to know.
These custom, you know, molded to your ear headphones from mm-hmm. Ultimate Ears and Jerry Harvey Audio and Westone, they take sound to a whole other level for small in-ear portable headphones. Mm-hmm. Matter of fact, in this blog that's probably coming out later this week, I compared the sound of a $400 Monster Turbine in-ear headphone, a universal fit headphone, to a $400 Ultimate Ear custom headphone. Mm-hmm. And it was really kind of shocking how much better the custom model was. So
really?
It's price for price the same, but it's a whole other world to use a now, custom.
Does that $400 include the custom molding from an audiologist?
No, you got me there, Scott. No, it doesn't. That could be about $100. But, you know, one of the things that's interesting about customs is, remember, these things were originally designed as onstage monitors for musicians.
Right, exactly.
They can last a really long time. And the part that breaks on headphones most of the time is the cable. So
right.
with all customs that I'm aware of, you can replace the cable yourself. It's a plug-in thing. So mm-hmm. when you break the cable, you buy a new cable and you're good to go.
Yeah.
So I've written some columns about headphones that they should last. Good headphones, you should get 10 years of use out of them. And if you think about amortizing that $400 or which turns into $500 with the getting the audiologist to make your ear molds, mm-hmm. and it works out to be $50 a year to own something like that, that's well worth doing.
Sure.
You have the $100 to start with.
I think Leo Laporte found at CES a company... I didn't catch them at CES, unfortunately, but that was something where they were custom molded, but not requiring an audiologist. You stick them in your ear
and they
expand out and you have to sit there quietly without talking and moving your jaw around and stuff
right.
for like 4 minutes. And then you get a custom fit earplugs. Have you seen those yet?
I've written about them. I haven't seen them in person, but basically it's a thing. Instead of having an audiologist take the molds, it's basically a headband that goes over your head, and it has the apparatus to squirt the liquid silicone into your ear and make the mold on the spot.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's
pretty
basically
cool.
Instant or 5 minute custom molded ear mold. But you have to go to that dealer, have them put the thing on your head and shoot the silicone into your ears.
It's not something you can do at home.
$200. No, you can't do it at home. And that's about $200. How good a headphone it is, I have no idea.
Yeah. I just saw recently a press release from the Consumer Electronics Association that there's been a recent spike in headphone sales. So this is apparently a good thing to be reporting on.
I did that.
You might have done that press release.
No, I made the spike myself.
Oh, yes. And somebody in the chat room mentioned a little earlier that wearing headphones also removes the whole acoustics issue. Right? Because you've only got them in you got them here. You don't have to worry about your room acoustics. Direct injection, yes.
Absolutely. Well, and by the way, you know, I want to point out something that a lot of people misunderstand about custom in-ear headphones or in-ear headphones in general, mm-hmm. is that for some reason, the whole idea of putting it in your ear implies that you're going to be more likely to damage your ears by playing them loud, mm-hmm. when it's actually the opposite, that because you're blocking out the ambient noise, to play it at an apparent level, you're playing them more quietly because you're not trying to overcome the ambient noise.
Well, that's an interesting point. I had never thought about that.
And it's significant. It's a big difference between how much isolation you can achieve with a custom in-ear headphone versus a universal fit or over-the-ear headphone. I mean, it's like a 10 dB difference. So to just make up a number, you can be listening at for an apparent level, 10 dB more quietly. So you're basically treating your ears a lot more gently.
Yeah, yeah. It's fantastic. I wish we had more time because I got a bunch more questions in the chat room and a bunch more questions from me personally. But we really are flat out of time. I want to thank you, Steve Guttenberg, for being my guest today. Wonderful conversation. Thanks so much.
It flew by.
It did fly by.
It did.
You can read Steve's blog on CNET at cnet.com/audiophiliac. And it's a great blog, by the way. I read it. Check in with it regularly myself. So I encourage everyone to do so. My online homes are ultimateavmag.com and hometheater.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv and follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott.
Hey, Scott, can you give me my Twitter?
Sure. Yeah. What's your Twitter?
My Twitter is @audiophiliacman.
Audiophiliac Man. So you can follow Steve's Twitter posts there, his tweets, and mine at HT Geek Scott. So there you go. Plenty of interesting stuff to follow on Twitter. Next week, my guest geek is scheduled to be Fred Bargetzi, the VP of Technology for Crestron, one of the premier home theater automation and AV distribution companies in the world. So we're going to go pretty high end there. Hope you'll join us. Until then, geek out.